Support for WPR comes from Present Music, performing honest music with guest violist and curator Nadia Sirota, May 9th at 8 at the Milwaukee Art Museum. Tickets and info are at presentmusic.org. Support for WPR comes from 4imprint, providers of promotional products for businesses, including embroidered apparel, trade show items, and logoed business gifts. More is at 4imprint.com. 4imprint, for certain.
Welcome to Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor, here to talk with you about what's new in healthy living, share some down-to-earth advice, and some great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. If you have a question for Zorba, here's the number to call, 1-800-462-7413, and you'll find a line open right now. Zorba, along with our callers, some interesting topics to talk about.
Yes, vitamins and nutritional supplements, are they pure or are they tainted? And if so, what does that mean for your health? And a study that may cause some mothers, potential mothers, to worry about a potential link between influenza and autism. Very controversial, small study, certainly worth discussing in terms of public health.
Okay, that's coming up. And our recipe.
Yes, sweet potato and apple casserole. It's a recipe from the vault.
That's coming up in, about 25 minutes or so. Our toll-free number again is 800-462-7413, 800-462-7413. Zorba, now let's welcome a caller in Jacksonville, Florida. Hi.
Hi.
How can we help?
Oh, you can, but let me first say, I love you guys. I do. Y'all are intelligent and entertaining, and that's a great combination.
Oh, aren't you nice? We love you, too.
Now, I do have a question.
Okay.
My husband says, 15 years ago, I went into a hot flash and never came out the other side.
And you're still with him, are you?
Yeah. He's been very tolerant. But he wears a sweatshirt, and I wear almost nothing. Yeah. Well,
wait a minute. Let me get that picture. Okay, go ahead.
Is there anything you can suggest? I've been to two of my doctors. One is was playing with my estrogen, and that really didn't help a lot. The other one prescribed an antidepressant, and I really don't need an antidepressant, but the side effect to that was diminishing the hot flashes. And it does work. However, the side effect to that pill is your hands shake, your voice shake, you know, whatever. And I would like to find something else, and I'm willing to try anything.
Mm-hmm. It's very interesting about hot flashes. There are a number of women who will say, you know, I had a hot flash or two, and then it's gone. And then there are other women who have hot flashes. I mean, I love what you said. You know, you went in once, went in the door, and that was it.
That was it.
And that actually is a percentage of the population. I don't know if anyone's ever done a study to see if it's 5 or 10%, but it is a significant part of the population.
Oh, lucky me.
Yes, wow. You're lucky. That's right, you're lucky. So, you know, if we look at the natural remedies, they don't do a lot. Black cohosh, which is one natural remedy that's been touted, acupuncture, all of those remedies really help, I think, with minor hot flashes or with hot flashes that are sort of on their way out, and they help people cope with them. But, the big guns that we have are antidepressants and estrogen. So I want to go back to each of those for just a second. You tried a couple of different estrogen products or just one?
No, I'm on Premarin. Mm-hmm. And that's okay. Because I had a hysterectomy. But mom and sister both had breast cancer, and my sister survived.
Right.
And so they want to avoid that, but I'm 65, so I'm ready to try anything.
Well, you're ready to try anything, but before you would try estrogen, and of course, if your mother and your sister had breast cancer, you know, estrogen is definitely a risk factor. So that kind of goes off way to the side. That's something that I would think twice about or three times about before taking it. So let's go to the antidepressant route. Now, there's not one antidepressant that works. There are several different antidepressants that work. And sometimes they work in very small amounts, and you don't even have to take them every day. But some women take them every other day or twice a week, and that's enough to make them work.
Wow.
And so it may be you were either on the wrong one or at the wrong dose. So my recommendation is generally the SSRI antidepressants, such as Zoloft, Paxil, Prozac, Celexa, are generally the antidepressants that are used for this. And what I would do is call your doc. Whatever one you try, don't try that one. Try a different one in the lowest dose. And then if that dose has side effects for you, take that dose, take the pill, break it in half with a little pill splitter and take half that dose, or take it once or twice a week. And that's what I would go to. I think that's a much safer thing for you to use versus hormone therapy. And I bet if you try a bit, that'll work. And if those antidepressants don't work, there are the old antidepressants called tricyclics. The most common one in that is called nortriptyline. That's the most common one. And that one you take at bedtime. And for some women, that works. So I think I would go the antidepressant route in small doses so that you're not getting the antidepression effect of the drug, but you're getting the side effect of the drug that may indeed help get rid of your hot flashes and make you a happier person.
I would like to be a happier person.
Thank you so much for your call.
I love your laugh. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks. We appreciate the call. For some women, Zorba, does this last forever?
Well, for some women, it does.
Really?
I have women who are in their late 70s, early 80s who still have hot flashes and have to take either very low dose estrogens or antidepressants. They just have a, you know, if you will, an exaggerated effect or a very strong effect to the lack of estrogen. For most women, it disappears over time, but for some, it does not.
1-800-462-7413, our toll-free number, 800-462-7413. And Zorba, a listener with us now from Lodi, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hello.
How can we help?
Well, I have a couple questions. I am a truck driver.
Mm-hmm.
And I have gotten tired, and I have seen this 5-hour energy. It's all over the country.
Oh, yeah, you see those ads all the time on TV.
And if a person uses it, is it habit-forming?
Well, first of all, have you been using 5-hour energy drink?
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
Did it work for you?
You're very much. But my question is it habit-forming?
No. Not at all. No more habit forming than coffee. And for me, coffee is habit forming. But if I stop coffee, I'm
Wait,
okay.
What is this stuff, caffeine?
It basically is a high-dose caffeinated drink. And then they put in a whole bunch of supplements, a number of supplements in there that they say will rev it up and give you more energy. But basically, the most important ingredient in that is really caffeine. And caffeine is what's keeping you up. And so no problem taking it. You can get it everywhere. Energy drinks have become sort of the number one growth industry within the soft drink industry, a 5-hour energy drink, Red Bull, a whole bunch of other things that get people awake. But most of the drinks contain caffeine, and they are certainly fine, and they're just like other caffeinated products. They may be a little habit-forming, but that's about as minimal habit-forming as you can possibly be. So,
how about effects on the mind and body? I mean, is there any effect as far as...
I don't think there are any major effects with this other than they keep you awake.
Yeah,
that's what these things do.
It's been in the news lately, these 5-hour energy drinks.
Right,
may be
right.
Bad for us. They say they may be linked to as many as 14 deaths, maybe
well,
attributed to
there
these
are a
drugs.
Number of companies, and the data made the news. It was on NBC. It was in the New York Times. I did the research. The FDA said these are generally recognized as safe. And so the real question is it the caffeine? Well, I don't think it's the caffeine and the supplements in them. I think it may be what people mix them with. And a lot of people mix these energy drinks with alcohol and drink them at bars. And if there's a death, then it's reported as a death, and it may be linked to the drink, but it may be really the alcohol.
Yeah, but the reporting suggested that maybe there's an overdose of caffeine in these drinks
well,
that may be dangerous.
I think the issue is kids may be drinking too much caffeine, and that might be the problem.
Thanks for the call. We appreciate
it. Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Have a good day.
You too. 800-462-7413. That's 1-800-462-7413. Zorba, you say that some nutritional supplements may have unexpected hazards?
Well, and this is a new report, which I think is really important. More than 50% of adults take vitamins, herbs, and nutritional supplements, with lots of nutritional supplements more and more being consumed every year. And Consumer Reports recently identified a whole slew of nutritional supplements that they think may be tainted with other things. They looked at a number of reports. They looked at more than 6,000 reports, 10,000 serious outcomes, probably 100 deaths to 150 deaths on supplements. And for the most part, they're supplements, not vitamins.
Wait, how many?
150 deaths over a five-year period.
And serious outcomes
Serious outcomes other than the death, hospitalization because of what supplements had. So to give an example, some of the supplements for cholesterol contained lovastatin in them, which is a cholesterol drug that we use. Mevacor was the name of lovastatin, and it was in red yeast. So people would take, hey, I took my red yeast supplement and my cholesterol is being lowered. Well, your cholesterol is being lowered because it doesn't just contain red yeast. It contains a drug called lovastatin that they manufacture and put into the drug.
That's seen as a...
an alternative, and it actually contains it. Some of the male enhancement products, and you know what I'm talking about when I say male enhancement, which were supposedly natural products, contain Viagra. So in other words, you know, I'm taking a Happy Man male enhancement product, and it really works, and it's natural, and it turns out it's tainted with Viagra. And these are often supplements that are produced in other countries, then come into this country, are put into a nice label,
These are prescription drugs we're talking about. Isn't there something illegal about using prescription drugs?
Well, first of all, yes, it is illegal. And in fact, for red yeast supplements, the FDA issued a cease and desist, and when the FDA looks at these things, they say you can't do that. It's a cease and desist order. But because supplements are regulated differently by the FDA, Orrin Hatch from Utah got a bill passed a number of years ago that said supplements should be regulated like cosmetics, not like drugs. And as a result, no one is minding the store. So I have a recommendation for our listeners, a very strong recommendation. There are two organizations that I think are bona fide test supplements for their purity. A, do they have what they say is in them, because a lot of supplements don't, and B, are they tainted? And those two organizations are Consumer Reports. Mm-hmm. I think they do a dynamite job. And another, consumerlab.org. And we'll put both of them, we'll put links on our website, zorbapastor.org. Consumer Reports, you can get from your library often by going through their link. It doesn't cost any money for many people or belong to the organization like I do, if you believe it. And consumerlabs.org, you belong. It's $25 a year. They are a dynamite organization, and they do independent testing.
Well, I understand the reasoning behind the government not really being involved in policing this, but if these other organizations, Consumer Reports
and Consumer Labs,
find this happening, then the feds should get involved.
What happens is when the feds get a complaint, then they do get involved. Exactly like you said, they do get involved. It's that you can have one supplement. Let's say you have Happy Male supplement, Happy Man supplement.
Right.
So you shut that down, and then you move across the street and you make Man Who Is Happy supplement.
In other words,
different label, do a different bottle, do
it's
a different name,
get a
shell
chain.
Company. And so you've got a supplement over there. So you should beware of supplements if you're going to take them. Make sure they're tested by an independent organization, and that's how you should spend your money.
Our toll-free number is 800-462-7413. And Zorba, our next caller is in Corvallis, Montana. Hi.
Hello, from the Bitterroot Valley.
How can we help?
Well, I am actually a very healthy 58-year-old vegetarian, except that probably five or six times a year I wake up with a horrible, horrible headache and vomiting to the extent I can't keep even water down. And this happened once very recently, right before a wellness exam, so I mentioned it to my doctor, and she suggested that I might be getting too much vitamin D. And so I thought that was really odd, but I am taking a vitamin D 5,000 unit pill and also calcium with D3. And so I quit both of those and haven't had an episode, but of course it's only been about 20 days. Mm-hmm. So I was just wondering what Dr. Zorba thinks. Could it be too much vitamin D3?
Yeah, that's interesting. How many thousand did you say?
Well, my doctor said you shouldn't get more than 2,000. Mm-hmm. And I looked at my D3 pill, and it's 5,000 mm-hmm. units. And then I looked at my calcium, and it's 1,000 units.
So you were getting 6,000 units of vitamin D. Well, there are a couple of things about vitamin D. First of all, you can check your vitamin D level. You can get a blood test. That's very easy to do. But I think your doctor's recommendation of about 2,000 units of D is right on for most people. 2,000 units of D is plenty of D. There's no reason to go above it. And if you worry that your vitamin D level is low at 2,000, stay on 2,000 for a month and get a vitamin D level test. That'll answer the question.
And I did have a blood test I did last year. I was high with vitamin D.
Well, but that doesn't mean that the vitamin D you have is causing the nausea and the effects that you have, just because your vitamin D level is high. So I'm not convinced that's the reason that you've got your symptoms. But on the other hand, I don't think you need more than 2,000 units of D if that turns out to produce a normal level. What I would do, like you said, it's only been 20 days, and you get this once every month or two. Stay on the lower level of vitamin D. Call me back in 2 years. If you haven't had a nausea episode, then I'll give you a diagnosis and say your doctor is right.
Okay.
Thanks for calling. You got to look at this over time.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Now, are there any bad effects of going over that 2,000?
Well, vitamin D, vitamin K, and vitamin A, and vitamin E are called fat-soluble vitamins. Mm-hmm. Take E out of the equation for a second. We know that too much A, too much D, and too much K can cause problems. And I'd have to look it up. I really don't know the symptoms of hypervitaminosis, but it's been known that fat-soluble vitamins, which are stored in the body, if you take too much of it, it can definitely cause problems. Now, water-soluble vitamins, which are the rest of the pack, they just disappear basically every day or so. They're out of your system. So we limit the amount of fat-soluble vitamins because of the side effects. And I'd have to look up I'm not primed on vitamin D toxicity, but you don't need 5,000 units. 2,000 is more than enough.
I didn't know there was a D test that you could take.
Yeah, you can take a blood test to see if you're vitamin D deficient.
Before we take another short break, Zorba, let's share a tip from the Zorba Pastor on Your Health inbox. This advice comes to us from John, who's seated in Murfreesboro, Illinois, and writes, "Dear Dr. Pastor, I was getting ready to ride my bicycle to work when I heard a caller on your excellent show talk about pain from his bicycle seat. I recommend a leather saddle. This old-school technology is superior to modern plastics, foam, and Kevlar. The leather supports the rider's weight like a stiff hammock. It is smooth, and it breathes unlike plastic. Not all bike shops carry them, but I order mine online. The leather saddle is the only way to roll. Happy trails, and keep up your good work."
That is great. I have never heard of leather saddles, but I can picture it. Can't you picture what it would look like on a bike seat in a leather saddle? I mean, it just kind of...
What do you mean? Didn't your bike have a leather saddle?
No, I think... You mean when I was a kid? No, we had a... I'm picturing it like a sling. In other words, it's not hard. You're sort of going down, your rump is sort of being held by a hammock,
well,
like you said.
Well, I hate to say it, but when I rode a bike, all I had was leather saddles.
Well, when you rode a bike back in 1900, the wheels were two stories high.
Let's move along.
And the women wore bustles.
Changing the topic. If you have a lifestyle tip or just want to take us for a ride, send your advice in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org. I don't even think radio was invented when you first learned to ride a bike.
We have our recipe coming up next. Stick around for that. It's from the vault. Lots more of your calls, of course, some more interesting research to talk over. And of course, our medical myth buster right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. 800-462-7413, our toll-free number. But Zorba, before we get back to the phones, recipe time, and we're going to do another past favorite for a special installment of Recipes from the Vault. Now, Zorba, we're headed back to the year of the Space Odyssey for this one. I'm pretty sure you didn't land on Jupiter. You can correct me if I'm wrong. But were you one of the first to jump on the iPod bandwagon?
I was not one of the first to jump on the iPod wagon. And although I've never been to Jupiter, people have said that I'm from Mars.
Remember when 2001 was considered way off
in
the future?
Totally. Space Odyssey, 2001, we'll be in a foreign place.
Boy,
I believed
what we're going to do in 2000.
I believed it, right. Right. Little
well,
did I know.
Here it is 11 years later and still worthy of a repeat, our sweet potato and apple casserole from that year,
yes,
2001.
And you know, the thing that I like about this particular recipe is that, first of all, it's sort of sweet potato time. I mean, people think about sweet potatoes this time of year, don't you?
I'm not much of a sweet potato fan.
But you don't, so you don't think about it.
I don't think about it.
You're not much of a sweet potato?
No, no.
It has vitamin A in it. Sweet potato is healthy.
It's okay.
How about sweet potato fries?
You know why?
Yeah, why?
I never grew up with sweet potatoes.
Oh, you never grew up
with
sweet potatoes.
You talk about your mom and mine, the same thing, the idea of meat potatoes,
we had sweet potatoes.
Peas.
That's right. We had sweet potatoes on Thanksgiving, and that was it. And it was sweet potatoes and yams with marshmallows in it, which is not my favorite thing at all. I know some people out there, their mouth is watering thinking about it, but I always sort of tried not to get it on my plate. It was my Aunt Bertha's favorite dish for Thanksgiving, and my mother loved Aunt Bertha. And so Aunt Bertha would always put a great big, here, have some sweet potatoes. And I'd have the great big blob of sweet potatoes on the plate, and I'd sit next to my mom, and she'd say, now, come on, eat your sweet potatoes.
I would just pass the dish to the next person.
Yeah, you see, your mom lets you do that.
Okay,
but also, sweet potatoes, plentiful this time of year.
Yeah.
Good recipe.
Yeah.
So start out with 6 medium sweet potatoes, cooked and sliced.
6 medium sweet potatoes, cooked and sliced.
Okay, so how do you cook your sweet potatoes?
Moving right along.
But you can bake them if you wanted to. That would be an excellent thing to do. And you can also nuke them. You can put them in the microwave. Mm-hmm. Why do we say nuke them when there's nothing radioactive about the microwave?
Well, it makes a noise. And
I think because it's like 2001.
Energy.
That's 2001. That's right. It was the cooking of the future. I still remember we got our first microwave, and there were all these recipes that you got with the microwave. Like you can bake this in the microwave, and you can cook eggs in the microwave.
Right.
What do we use the microwave for? Heating up leftovers and vegetables.
I heat my coffee in the morning.
Heating up your coffee in the morning. That's it. When was the last time you baked a casserole in the microwave? Okay, moving right along.
Yeah.
6 golden delicious apples sliced. Now, please.
6 golden delicious apples. Yeah, let me do my part. 6 golden delicious apples sliced.
Now, golden delicious. Now, this is 2001. Do you think I would say golden delicious today?
I don't know.
No, I probably wouldn't because they're not my favorite apple anymore.
You wouldn't use those apples.
No, I would probably use Roma. You know, I would use that, or I would use a Honeycrisp. I don't know if Honeycrisp was around in 2001, but that's my favorite apple. What is your favorite apple?
Well, we've gone through this. I eat regular delicious, you know, apples.
You like delicious apples?
Yeah, I kind of do.
I don't quite understand you, but I haven't understood you for years.
Yeah, right.
1 cup of orange juice.
Cup of OJ.
1 cup of brown sugar.
Cup of brown sugar.
1 tablespoonful of margarine.
A big tea margarine.
A dash of salt.
Dash of salt.
2 tablespoonfuls of cornstarch.
2 big tea cornstarch.
A tablespoonful of cinnamon.
A big tea cinnamon.
1/4 teaspoon of ginger, ground ginger.
Mm-hmm. 1/4 teaspoon ground ginger.
1/8 teaspoon of allspice.
1/8 teaspoon allspice.
What do you think allspice is?
A lot of spices.
It seems like it is, but it's not. It's just called allspice.
All of them.
It's kind of a relative.
All of them mixed together.
Yeah, mix all the spices in your cabinet together and then put it in here. I don't think so.
All right.
Oh, this is way too much fun. Okay, preheat the oven at 350 degrees. Slice the cooked sweet potatoes into 1/3 inch slices. So So as I said, you could put them in the microwave or bake them in the oven. Mm-hmm. Peel the apples and remove the cores. Slice them into 1/3-inch rings. Grease a 9x13 glass dish and layer the potatoes and apples alternately. Set that aside. Then in a medium saucepan, combine the orange juice, sugar, margarine, salt, and cornstarch. Bring it to a boil. Pour over the mixture, over the potatoes and apples. Sprinkle with the spices. Bake for 30 minutes and serve warm. Doesn't that sound good?
Mm-hmm.
It's not convincing at all. Doesn't that sound good? Come on.
That really sounds good.
Listen, it's not tofu. I didn't mix any tofu in this.
It
sounds good.
And I don't hate sweet potatoes.
They don't hate you either.
Oh, good.
They don't hate you either. It's got about 300 calories per serving, a lot of potassium in this, obviously very little protein. Wonderful dish that I think all of you might like to have and might like to make.
Don't leave your recipes lying in a vault. Give them some air and send them along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
And if you want a copy of today's recipe, visit our website at
ZorbaPastor.org. And while you're there, you can sign up for our weekly podcast and search all of your favorite Zorba Pastor On Your Health recipes. That's ZorbaPastor.org. And don't forget, you can find us on Facebook.
1-800-462-7413 is our toll-free number. 800-462-7413. Now, Zorba, back to the phones. A listener with us in Los Angeles, California. Hi.
Hi.
What's up?
Well, I've been recently diagnosed with hypothyroidism, and one of the biggest symptoms that I've shown is weight gain, and I was wondering if maybe I could get some tips and advice on maybe some foods that I can avoid or eat more of or things that I can help my condition.
Oh, sure. So you said hypothyroidism. So in other words, they took a thyroid test and said you had a low level of thyroid hormone. Is that correct?
Yes. I believe she thinks that I have Hashimoto's, I think I'm more on the hypo than hyper.
So are you on thyroid medication now?
Yes.
How long have you been on it?
About a month and a half now.
Okay, good. Good month and a half. It's sort of the beginning of it. It takes a while before your body readjusts. Have you been gaining weight over the last year or two?
Yes, I've gained about 45 pounds. And I'm young. I'm 22. So it's not very common for people my age to just kind of gain that much weight,
Well, first of all, weight gain is common in the whole United States, but to gain that much weight in that period of time, you are exactly correct. That is unusual. And getting your thyroid essentially into a normal value where the thyroid hormone is not too low and not too high is exactly what you want to do. It's extremely important to be able to do that. And over time, it's going to help you. But now you've got these pounds that you've managed to put on, and it's a matter of trying to get rid of that weight. So what sort of thing are you on? Any kind of a special diet? Are you going to Weight Watchers? What are you doing?
Well, I'm currently a student, so I don't go to Weight Watchers.
Mm-hmm.
My diet consists of Lean Cuisines. Whatever I get on campus, but it's not anything incredibly unhealthy. I usually try to eat on the healthier side, though.
So what I would recommend is two things. First of all, you've got to increase what I would call your metabolic set point. So what sort of exercise are you getting? Tell me what you're doing.
Well, I ride my bike and I walk a lot.
Okay, you ride your bike. How much and how much do you walk?
I walk every day. I'd say about maybe 2 miles a day. Total, riding my bike, probably the same. I kind of alternate. In terms of me going out and exercising, I usually go out for a jog maybe once a week. But I haven't really been making much of an effort. At the beginning of the school year, I was working out every day.
You've got to ramp up that effort. That's number one.
That sounds like an okay.
No, I think what you've got to do is sweat for 20 to 25 minutes if you want to get rid of it. Sweating means you're really using your muscles. You're burning those calories. And I think if you're walking and you're not sweating, as we often do when we walk, and you're riding your bike and you're not sweating, you're not going to burn off those calories. So I think you've got to sweat 20 to 25 minutes a day, 5 days a week. That's number one. So I think you've got to have that much. And like you said, the beginning of the semester, you were going to the gym. Not unusual. I often head over to the gym, and I notice that in September, you know, or at the beginning of January, people are just going to the gym and they're exercising, and you can just see the graph. It kind of goes down, falls down about a month later, and all of a sudden, you know, those machines that you wanted to get on are empty. Before that, there was a line, and now they're empty. Why the machines want people versus people wanting the machines. So sweating 5 to 6 days a week, critically important. Next step, calories, calories, calories. You know, we look at it a whole variety of ways. You know, you look at diet book number 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5, and, you know, the 5-minute diet, the 5-hour diet, the 5-century diet. No matter which way you look at it, calories are always critical. The type of food you eat is critical, but so are calories. So if you go to MyPlate, myplate.gov, that's the government website from the USDA, and you can calculate out the number of calories you need to sort of fuel your body. And basically what you want to do is calculate those calories based on your height, your weight, your age, and then take away 25% of them. And that's what you need to have every day. And you can't exceed that. So, you know, looking at your age, it's going to be somewhere in probably the 1,200 to 1,400 calorie range, somewhere within there, if I were to guess. And then you've got to sort of pay attention. And you can do that with a variety of websites. I like Loseit, LoseIt.com. They're good. It's on my smartphone. I can look up foods. Weight Watchers has a website. Of course, you have to join them and pay a fee. But you've got to keep track of those calories, and you've got to exercise.
Well, now you say, though, Zorba, that hyperthyroidism is
hypothyroid.
Right. Is largely responsible for this.
Well, no, I said it's one of the factors in there. But even when your thyroid goes back to normal, you've got to then extend more effort to get the weight off. Because the body, for some reason that we do not understand, once it packs on pounds, it tends to stay there. You know, we're a feast or famine. We're hunters and gatherers. And so our body slows down its metabolism to keep the weight on. So that's why you've got to ramp it up in order to take it off.
Oh, thank you so much.
Yep. Thank you so much for the call. We appreciate it.
You know, one of the issues with weight is it's such a problem in America, and it's so difficult. And here it is, like this young woman, she says she goes out and exercise, she rides her bike, and she walks. Mm-hmm. But in the scheme of things, she may just be engaging in the normal amount of exercise that all of us should be doing every day. To get the weight off, we have to do an extraordinary amount of exercise to burn off the calories.
If I remember correctly, from all the years we've been doing this, the diet probably is more important than the exercise.
Absolutely. The diet is much more important than the exercise. The exercise helps, but the diet is key.
800-462-7413, toll free, 1-800-462-7413. On we go, Zorba, to Jacksonville, Florida now. Hi.
Hi.
How can we help?
Well, my 8-month-old daughter was diagnosed with kidney reflux when she was 3 months old. And they put her on antibiotics, and my question is whether or not she should be taking those antibiotics.
How old is she now?
8 months.
Oh, so she's 8 months old. And how long has she been on the antibiotics?
For about 5 months.
About 5 months. And she had recurrent urinary tract infections before that?
At 3 months old, she had a severe UTI, and she was in the hospital for 3 days.
Mm-hmm. That's severe.
And then they did the tests, and the urologist gave her this, what they call Septra, and they said it's preventative antibiotic, but I don't really know what all that means.
Well, there are a couple of things. Septra is a sulfa drug. It's been around, sulfa drugs have been around since the 30s. They've been around for a long time, 80 years, 70 years, something like that. For children, they really have been used long-term for many, many years and have been found to be extraordinarily safe drugs to use. So what you have to do as a parent is you have to weigh two things. You have to weigh the benefits of the drug against the risk of not taking the drug. So you kind of look at it that way. Okay, so if it were my child, the answer is I would stay on the drug to keep the urinary tract infection from happening. The question I would ask is, how long does my child have to be on the drug?
Yeah.
When do we test it again? Is there some surgery that we have to do later on? Is this something that my child grows out of and so on? So those are the questions I would ask. But the possibility of kidney disease, you know, in a young child is something you absolutely want to avoid. And here it is, you're using a safe drug. We used to use these drugs, by the way, Many years ago, these drugs were used to prevent otitis media, ear infections. And in children who had recurrent ear infections, and this was before the modern era where we put tubes in the ears, we often would put children on these drugs for a year or two if they had recurrent infections to keep the infections from happening. So there's a really, really good track record for these, and I would encourage you to keep her on the drug.
Oh, that's great to hear. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you so much, and good luck to you.
Good luck.
800-462-7413. And before a short break, Zorba, you'll have to put on your pilot wing pin for another edition of Traveling Tips from Zorba. Today's question comes to us from Joan in Madison, Wisconsin, who's about to take a very impressive trip. She writes, Ni Kao, that's hello in Chinese. I'm 77 years old and planning for an upcoming trip to China. This will be the longest air trip I've ever made. I was wondering if you recommend using compression socks to prevent blood clots. I want to wake up refreshed and ready to hit the ground running. Thanks, and I appreciate your sage advice.
Sage advice. By the way, it's not ni hao, it's ni hao. That's much, much better. Yeah, that's right. My daughter-in-law is Chinese, so it's a tonal language. You have to
ni
say
hao.
It. Yeah, that no. Ni hao. I think it's like oh, something like that.
Yeah.
Anyway, okay. Compression stockings. They're excellent. They often really help people. Will they prevent blood clots? They'll reduce the risk. How much do they reduce the risk? I don't think anyone's ever quantitated it. They feel good for a lot of people. Getting up and moving around the airplane, really important if you can do it, because these are long, long flights. You know, 10 and 12 hour flights can really be very difficult. I take long flights. I go to India or Asia. I go generally now. Recently, I've gone once a year, and I don't wear compression stockings. But I've thought about it, and I wear a very tight new sock that I put on, and I feel much better now. Are you going to hit the ground running when you have been on an airplane for 12 hours so you wake up refreshed? Probably not. I mean, being on an airplane is not fun for 12 hours. If you're going first class, which generally costs somewhere around $10,000, maybe you'll wake up refreshed. But generally, I go in steerage, so I'm kind of cramped up and trying to get a little bit of sleep on the plane. So I don't think you're going to wake up hitting the ground running. But you may wake up and your legs may not be swollen, and that in itself is a benefit.
Before you lift off, make sure to check in with Zorba. Just send your traveling questions in an email to
zorba@wpr.org.
We have an interesting topic to talk about. That's coming up next. Some more of your calls, of course, and our medical myth buster right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. That toll-free number is 800-462-7413. But Zorba, before we take our next call, here's a study that tentatively links flu in pregnancy to autism.
To autism. So let's look at the study. So before we go anywhere with the study, it's a small study. It's a tiny study. You can't make any conclusions from this study. However, before we get good studies to determine things, sometimes we have studies that give us an idea.
So what is this little study?
Well, they looked at this small study. They looked at moms who were pregnant between 1996 and the year 2002. And they had done lots of research looking to see what their health was like during the pregnancy. And they kept track, looked at their records, looked at whether or not they got sick or ill during the pregnancy, whether or not they had coughs or colds, or whether they had kidney infections. And one of the things they kept track of was influenza. Influenza is what we get the shot for. Now, flu as a term, we call flu a lot of things. Like, I've got the cold, I've got a flu, you know, I've got the stomach flu. But I'm talking about influenza, that for which we get a shot every year if we want to stay healthy. And lo and behold, they found the possibility that there was an increased risk of autism, infantile autism, autism as little babies, in moms who had influenza. It was a very small risk. The rate of autism in this population was 1%. And when they looked at infantile autism, autism that occurs very early during a baby's life, that rate was roughly double for moms who had influenza. Not a big study. It's not a huge study. We can't draw major conclusions. However, it's a little bit of a troubling trend.
Yeah. Not to panic over that at this stage, but something we ought to be really careful about is getting that flu shot, influenza.
Well, and I think that's sort of when I look at this and I go, well, you know, as a mom, you want to make sure you're doing everything right. You know, you avoid alcohol, you avoid smoke, you avoid passive smoking with tobacco, you try to exercise and eat right. But how many moms think of getting an influenza shot and making sure that they don't get influenza and don't necessarily put that at the top of their list? And I think, you know, this very, as I said, this study where you can't draw conclusions still possibly shows a trend. We know autism is increasing in Western societies. We don't know why. Maybe influenza is a factor.
Do you get your flu shot?
Oh, I get my flu shot every year. Now, years ago, we're talking about 20 or 25 years ago, I was cavalier and I didn't get an influenza shot. And I remember one year I caught influenza and it was awful. I was really sick. It was not a cold. It was the worst cold you could say
I ever had. So Dr. Heal myself.
Oh, yes. Yeah, so for the last couple of decades, I've had my flu shot. You should get your flu shot. Flu shots are important, not just for older folks, not just for folks who work with people, but for pregnant moms.
1-800-462-7413. It's toll-free. And Zorba, our next caller is a listener in Augusta, Georgia. Hi.
Hi there.
How can we help?
I'm wondering, what is the nutritional difference in consuming sprouted pumpkin and sunflower seeds versus just organic raw pumpkin and sunflower seeds?
So are you talking about sprouts, pumpkin sprouts, or you mean the seeds themselves, the difference between regular seeds and organic seeds?
I've had a brand of seeds that were sprouted raw pumpkin and sunflower seeds,
mm-hmm.
but then I've also had just organic raw seeds. So
first of all, do the seeds look exactly the same to you?
No, I guess the sprouted ones look a little bit lighter in color.
Mm-hmm. But they're still a seed. The reason that I'm asking is there are sprouts like alfalfa sprouts, you know, that we eat, mung beans that are sprouts. And that's, you know, in the salad section of the store. But from a seed point of view, you know, if you're just looking at seeds, I don't think there's going to be any difference between organic sprouted seeds and organic seeds. We know that organic seeds mean that there are no pesticides and fungicides used for the seeds. Mm-hmm. And I think from a seed point of view, if you're going to eat organic, a seed is one of those things you really want to be careful about, you know, if organics means something to you. But I think whether or not they're sprouted organically or not is not going to make any difference, because once you harvest the seed from the plant, it's not going to make a difference how the plant actually was initiated through sprouting or not. So I'd say they're pretty much the same. I have a question. Was one more expensive than the other?
Yeah, that's exactly why I'm asking.
Aha! You see? Insight.
My mom likes to buy this brand that's sprouted, and it's like twice as expensive, and I wasn't convinced that it was worth it for that much more money, so.
I'm not convinced either. So you can tell your mom, save her money and just buy some organic seeds and spend the rest of the time eating some other organics that she'd like to eat. I am on your side 100%. I don't think it's worth the money that she's spending. You can tell that to your mom.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much.
Sure. Oh, you're welcome. Thank you so much for the call. We appreciate it. Zorba, time again for our medical myth buster now. Today's claim deals with some research that is, shall I say, on the cutting edge. We always hear from the surgeon or from the people that we talk with before the surgery that we shouldn't eat before the surgery. But now some are saying that carbs could actually help quicken the cure. So could starches actually ramp up recovery after surgery?
Well, you know, it's interesting. We know that carbohydrate loading before kids go out and play soccer games, you know, tends to be very important. I have four kids. They all played soccer. You know, before the big soccer games, they'd load up on pasta and bread. And, of course, they were all young and healthy, and they weren't gaining weight because they were out there playing soccer all the time. And so the questions are whether or not that will help you recover. And there have been a couple of studies that show the carb loading before surgery. Now, we're not talking about the minute before surgery, but carb loading before surgery may lessen your stay in the hospital and may cause a quicker return of gut function if you're having abdominal surgery.
But now, usually they say you can't eat anything for like the whole day or hours anyway. Before.
Well, it's not the whole day. What happens is there's a certain number of hours. Some surgeries, they'll say 6 hours.
Yeah.
Some surgeries, they'll say 8 hours. You know, don't consume a meal. And this is because of nausea during the surgery.
Right.
And you've got to pay attention to that because that's a safety issue. But prior to that, it may be useful, and there are a couple of little studies that show that it may be useful, to carb load you so that you've got glycogen, which is fast glucose, in your liver for your gut, for your body to be able to access during the surgery or after the surgery. Surgery is really stressful to the body. I mean, think about it. You're put to sleep, and somebody's cutting you with a knife and attacking your body, and so your body is responding physiologically, and having this glycogen, which is quick energy in your liver, is really not a bad idea. And so the answer is yes, there are some studies that show that. It's not a total myth, but you've got to pay attention to when your last bite of food has to be. Otherwise, you're not going to get that surgery when you go into the hospital or surgery center to get it.
Have a myth to go under Zorba's knife? Send it along to the show in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Back to the phones now, Zorba. We welcome a listener in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Zorba.
How can we help?
I've been enjoying your show for many years. I have a question about wheat. I've always eaten a lot of whole grains in my diet on a daily basis, and I've recently read a book by a preventive cardiologist called Wheat Belly. It was a New York Times bestseller. In the book, he makes a compelling case that all forms of wheat are not good for you. It doesn't matter if it's a Twinkie or a slice of organic whole wheat bread with no preservatives. What gives, Zorba? I was wondering if you had any thoughts on this matter.
Yeah, I know someone who's read that book, too, and is trying to go off all wheat. Not even whole wheat, which I always thought was good. But
yeah, I have, too.
Yeah.
And you hear about gluten-free all the time, too, and I wonder if wheat is that bad for you.
Yeah, I don't know whether this is what you've heard, but I've heard that supposedly with all the new pesticides and things that they – now the wheat is grown. We don't see the wheat fields, tall wheat blowing in the wind anymore. It's little tiny wheat that they can keep on harvesting and do a whole lot of crops, and it's all the modern chemical junk ruins it.
Yeah, well, not only that, the original wheat indigenous to the planet Earth was discovered in about 3300 BC when it was harvested, and it's been genetically modified so much through the centuries that what we call wheat now has nothing to do with that wheat.
I think Zorba's rolling his eyes.
Not really nice. I'm just thinking about the wheat conspiracy. And who's in charge of the wheat conspiracy? You know, and it reminds me of Gordon Roselip, who used to be a state senator in our state, who made the remarkable statement that margarine was a communist plot to corrupt our youth.
Yeah, and then they tested him. We voluntarily took the test. Tell the difference between margarine and butter.
You couldn't tell the difference. That's right. I mean, so I think about food conspiracies. And food conspiracies, by the way, have been around for hundreds of years. Vegetarianism, veganism, and everything. There's always the latest conspiracy of this and that. But let's look at wheat. So first of all, for some people, wheat is an issue. And those are people who are gluten intolerant. And there's a gluten intolerance called celiac disease. In its severe form, you can do a biopsy of the small intestine, and wheat is bad, and it has to do with a whole bunch of things. It doesn't matter what kind of wheat you're eating, whether it's organic wheat, whether it's traditional wheat, whether it's the new wheat that's produced, it's bad for those people. And then coming back from there, there are other people who notice that they can't tolerate wheat products. For them, that I think is an important issue. But I've not read the Wheat Belly book. I looked at the introduction, went through part of it, and I think basically it's a book to sell the latest diet. That wheat is bad for you, and you've got to get wheat out of of the system because it's a bad product, and it goes so on and so forth. And I've seen these types of books that come on all the time where it says, this is something bad, let's get rid of it. And basically, if you got rid of everything that every book said that it was bad, you'd be drinking water, starve, and die because, you know, there's something bad in everything. If you remember years ago, it was the yeast, the anti-yeast diet. We have too much yeast in our system, you know, and then we accent things. So I don't think you have to throw out the baby with the bathwater. What you have to do is look and say, wheat is a product that we eat. Americans are eating too much food. Wheat is part of that too much food, and it's pretty much in a lot of prepared foods. If you're intolerant, stop using it. But I don't think just because, quote, the person who wrote it is a preventive cardiologist does not mean that their data is really strong. And the data from this, and I've read a number of views, I think is really weak. Does that give you any answer?
Yes.
So I have a question for you.
Sure.
Now, are you on a wheat-free diet?
No. Okay. No, I'm not, and I've always... On a daily basis, I've always ate a fair amount of whole grains because that's what I was told was good for me. Yeah.
They are good.
And then you read this book and it says you're killing yourself.
Yeah, you're killing. Yeah, I don't believe that. I think it's a hoax.
Okay.
I think that you're killing yourself as a hoax. See, I believe in moderation in all things. And in all seriousness, I think that's where it fits. And I want to make a little side for this. The latest data on fish oil shows that fish oil capsules do not do what we thought they would do. They do indeed change our good and our bad cholesterol. But they don't appear to prevent heart disease and stroke. Now, the data on fish is really very, very strong, that people who have a serving of fish once or twice a week do well. Well, there's more in fish than just fish oil. And there's more in – it's not just wheat that's an issue. It's what's the wheat in? Is it whole grain? How are we eating it? And how are the other foods going when we're eating it too that makes a difference? So I think I would throw away the book and continue with whole wheat products.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Appreciate the call. And before we check out for the week, Zorba, let's take care of a little Zorba Pastor on Your Health grammar police business. Daniel from Racine, Wisconsin, thinks that your advice to patients may be a little too severe. He writes, I am a general internist, and I appreciate all the caring, common sense advice you give to patients. However, I have an item for the Dr. Zorba grammar police. You often use the word regime to refer to a plan of action. A regime is what Fidel Castro has been running in Cuba. I believe you mean to say regimen, which is the proper word to describe a treatment plan for a patient. Other than this, you have rarely made a mistake. Very impressive.
I love it. I love it. I know I've been accused of being just like Fidel. That's great. Yes, I shall change my ways. Unlike Fidel, I shall change my ways.
If you have a new grammar regimen for Zorba, join the Zorba Pastor on Your Health Grammar Police by sending an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
We will see you next week, Zorba.
Stay well, Tom.
If you missed anything during the show or just want to download our show podcast, visit us on the web
at ZorbaPastor.org. And don't forget, you can find us on Facebook.
And don't forget, you can call us anytime at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's not intended as a medical diagnosis, so please do check with your doc. This show was produced by Todd Witter with help from Gabrielle Pedriani. Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich, and our technical director is Brad Kohlberg. Our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, hoping you'll be with us for the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 1124Z. More information on Zorba, his clinic, and healthy living, including heart-healthy recipes, podcasts, and show archives, is available online at zorbapastor.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.